witnessed this massive suicide bombing in Quetta, which is the provincial capital in Balochistan province. And it killed dozens of people.
We have the latest for you into what happened when Pakistan's people went to the polls Wednesday. This is Thursday, July 26th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. You are part of this program. Please join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also coming up, the U.S. president reacts to reports of possible progress by North Korea. And an idea is being circulated saying the rhinoceros could thrive down under in Australia. It's all on today's VOA Asia. In Pakistan, the polls are closed and vote counting is underway as nearly 106 million people cast their ballots in Wednesday's violence-marred general elections. Just hours after voting began, a powerful suicide blast outside a polling station in Quetta killed more than 31 people and wounded 40 others. The radical Islamic State took responsibility for plotting the carnage. Police say the victims included voters, police personnel, and political party activists. Reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad spoke Wednesday night with VOA's Sarah Williams about the election, beginning with that outbreak of violence.
We witnessed this massive suicide bombing in Quetta, which is the provincial capital in Balochistan province, and it killed dozens of people. And then there were some separate clashes between activists of rival political parties, plus a convoy of polling staff was ambushed by militants in Balochistan again. And that also left four people dead, including Pakistani troops. So, yes, that was the area where we were expecting some violence, because that is where Islamic State has carried out massive bombing. And that province of Pakistan obviously borders Afghanistan, where Pakistani officials say Islamic State has its bases. But otherwise, overall, across Pakistan, the voting process was relatively peaceful. And, yeah, it was like a 10-hour day for the Election Commission had designated for the voters, which has now, the process has now concluded and the counting has begun.
Now, this election contest, it seems like it's between the parties of former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif's Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz and the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, or PTI, which is led by the internationally famous cricket star Imran Khan. Apparently, these are the two parties that are leading in the contention.
That's true. These are the parties, and that was where everybody was focusing on, because Imran Khan's party has obviously gained over the last years a lot of support, and it has emerged as a major challenge for former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif's political party, which has strong bases in the Punjab province, which is the most populous province of Pakistan.
Ayaz Ghul reporting from Islamabad. Now, there could be trouble ahead. Over the past few hours, the head of Pakistan's former ruling party has rejected the results of the parliamentary elections before the results are announced, claiming the vote was rigged. Shahbaz Sharif, who heads the Pakistan Muslim League party, said the results of Wednesday's vote were being tampered with. He did not provide any evidence or elaborate. His allegation came hours after the closing of polls Wednesday, although the country's elections oversight body was yet to announce even the first results of the elections. As we continue on VOA Asia, we'll take a closer look into the election options and the future of Pakistan. Stay with us. These are among the top Asia stories currently trending on VOAnews.com. At least 19 people have been confirmed dead in the wake of Monday's catastrophic dam collapse in southern Laos that left thousands of residents homeless and hundreds more missing. At least 15 officials at a Chinese drug manufacturer have been detained as part of an investigation that had produced false records involving its rabies vaccine. Three U.S. airlines have agreed to China's demands to change how it refers to Taiwan on their websites ahead of a Wednesday deadline imposed by Beijing. American Airlines, Delta Airlines, and United Airlines removed the name Taiwan from the results of its destination searches, using instead the name Taipei, the island's capital. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the VOAnews.com website. Who will be the next leader of Pakistan, and what will that mean to the United States and the rest of the world? That's what I asked Michael Kugelman. He's the Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center.
I think that what's most likely, the most likely outcome is, a hung parliament, which basically means no one party wins an absolute majority, and the party that does win the most votes needs to essentially form a power-sharing agreement and govern in a coalition. I think that's what we're most likely to see. If I had to put money on it, I would say that the PMLN would eke out a narrow victory, but it could certainly go the other way, too.
Imran Khan has made some statements that cannot be to the liking of the United States. When he has referred to Iran, it has been quite positive. When he has referred to the Taliban, sometimes it's been positive. How would an Imran Khan victory make its way as far as relationships between the United States and Pakistan?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, what would an Imran Khan victory mean for U.S.-Pakistan relations, which are already quite stressed at the moment? I think that the context is important here. Plenty of Pakistani politicians say nasty things about the U.S. that plays well with public opinion, which tends to be pretty anti-American in Pakistan. Though it's true that Imran Khan does go a bit further. One thing that he's most famous or infamous for saying a few years ago is that if he were to be in power, he would give the order to shoot down American drones in Pakistan. I think that, quietly, they wouldn't admit this publicly, but I think quietly there are some, officials, U.S. government officials in Washington that would be a bit nervous and weary if Imran Khan were to take office. And he has some pretty senior advisors who have also been quite shrill and strident in their anti-American messaging. But this is the thing. Typically the army in Pakistan runs the show when it comes to policy toward the U.S. and the U.S.-Pakistan relationship. So I think that on one level one could assume that if Imran Khan were to win, the army would still be controlling policy toward the U.S. And it's U.S.-Pakistan relationship's in bad shape now. But it wouldn't necessarily get worse because a Prime Minister Khan is in power. If the army is still calling the shots, it would be able to moderate his harsh rhetoric. But then again, going back to the personality issue, and I've written about this recently, that I don't necessarily see Imran Khan as someone who would be willing to give space to the army on policy toward the U.S., which has clearly been something that Khan feels very strongly about. He has a lot of ideas about how he thinks the relationship should be. So if he does push back against the army, I think that could raise the very likely possibility of a new era of political volatility rooted in a deepening of civil-military relations, which were, very, very strained during the last government as well. So the bottom line is I don't necessarily think that the election and its various outcomes will have much of an impact on U.S.-Pakistan relations because the army runs the show no matter what. But, if you have Khan in there and he starts trying to push back against the army and he starts trying to exert himself that way, that could be notable, but I'm not sure it would come to that.
Is Imran Khan a trusted person in Pakistan? Are there doubts about his ability to be the leader of the country?
I find Imran Khan is just truly one of the most fascinating figures in South Asia, in my view. Here's someone who is a national hero because of his cricket exploits. 1992, he led his Pakistan to a world championship in cricket. That was one of the biggest joys ever in the history of Pakistan. Even now, nothing has been like that. He was revered. He was no one disliked him. Then he turned to politics, and I would argue he's now become maybe one of the most polarizing figures in Pakistan. There are plenty of people that love and trust him. He's got supporters that simply fawn over him. He has a cult of personality effect. But then there are plenty of others, particularly the more liberal Pakistanis, who feel that he's a complete disaster. They refer to him as Taliban Khan because of his the fact that he's always talked about the need to negotiate with terrorists, not fight them. They talk about, the people that don't like him simply say that he's a disaster, that he's hypocritical, he's erratic, and there's no reason to trust him. And I don't know if there's a middle ground. So You know, I think that given his personality, which again is rather mercurial and unpredictable, given the fact that neither he nor his party have ever held national power, I think there is a bit reason to be a bit weary if he and the party were to take over the government. But again, that's not to say that things wouldn't settle down. I mean, he does have a number of aides, high-level aides, that have been in the politics business for decades and have come from other parties. So I think that eventually things would stabilize, but at least initially, I do think that because of his personality and his lack of experience, people will be a bit concerned about what Imran Khan would bring to the table as a prime minister.
Michael Kugelman, the deputy director of the Asia Program and senior associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center. Check out our website at voanews.com for the latest in the results from the Pakistan elections. Happening now in Asia, U.S. President Donald Trump accuses China of targeting American farmers in a vicious way and using them as leverage to get concessions on trade a day after the administration announced a $12 billion farm aid package. The young soccer teammates and their coach, who were rescued after being trapped in a cave in northern Thailand, were ordained Wednesday at a Buddhist temple. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We are happy you're with us on VOA Asia. President Donald Trump has praised recent satellite images that indicate North Korea appears to have begun the process of dismantling some key facilities at the Sohae Satellite Launching Station on the country's northwest coast. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said such activities would be consistent with the commitment North Korean leader Kim Jong-un made to Trump in Singapore. VOA diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports from the State Department.
North Korea's nuclear threat was one of the topics on the agenda when Secretary Pompeo and Defense Secretary Jim Mattis met with their Australian counterparts in California. Satellite images taken of the launching facility in June and then 1 month later in July appear to show dismantling activity. Pompeo had a cautious response.
We've been pressing for there to be inspectors on the ground when that engine test facility is dismantled, consistent with Chairman Kim's commitment. And I'll leave it at that for this morning.
Asked what further steps North Korea needs to take, Pompeo had this reply.
That's easy. They need to completely, fully denuclearize. That's the steps that Chairman Kim committed to and that the world has demanded through UN Security Council resolutions. It's that straightforward.
On Capitol Hill, some lawmakers were also cautiously optimistic.
This is the first sign that there may be some movement by the North Korean regime in the direction of meeting the commitments that were made. It would be more encouraging to me if we saw the return of the remains of Americans killed in action during the Korean War. It would be even more encouraging if there were some detailed plan discussed about how irreversible and verifiable denuclearization might happen, but this is an encouraging first step.
After their summit in June, Trump said Kim had promised him that a major missile engine testing site would be destroyed soon. But their agreement contained no details about when or how North Korea would abandon its nuclear weapons program or shut down its existing nuclear facilities. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
Coming your way, could the future see rhinoceros with an Australian accent? You're listening to VOA Asia.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This news alert from VOA Asia. The head of Pakistan's former ruling party has rejected the results of that country's parliamentary elections before the results are even announced, claiming the vote was rigged. Shahbaz Sharif, who heads the Pakistan Muslim League Party, said the results of the vote were being tampered with. He did not provide any evidence or elaborate. Asian markets closed mixed on Wednesday, with benchmarks in Japan and Hong Kong tracking higher after Wall Street mostly advanced on the back of strong corporate results overnight. Visit VOA Asia Facebook every day for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. We continue now. As all five species of rhino in Africa and Asia are endangered or face extinction, an Australian-based professor and conservationist suggests that Australia might be a good place for some rhinos to be protected and rebuild their numbers within the confines of cattle stations or other enclosed areas. Bill Lawrence is a distinguished professor at the James Cook University in Cairns. He spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty about efforts by European scientists who recently created hybrid embryos from sperm of the last deceased northern white rhino in the laboratory.
This is really getting down to sort of Jurassic Park type desperation. But the last male of the northern white rhino died in March. So there's two females left. So they're using frozen sperm and harvested eggs, and they've created essentially embryos in test tubes. And now what they're going to do is actually try to implant those in a southern white rhino female. So you're going to kind of have a little bit of a hybrid offspring, and that it'll be genetically a northern white rhino, but it'll be born to a southern white rhino mother. It's not an ideal situation, but this, as they say, desperate times call for desperate measures, and this is really getting down to extremely difficult situation.
Well, when we talk about rhinos in general, there are a number of subspecies, but the animal itself is endangered, isn't it?
Yeah, there's five species of rhinos, and they're all pretty much in bad shape. The one that's in the best shape of all is the southern white rhino, but it was knocked down to a century ago. There were only 20 individuals of it alive at all, and it's made an amazing comeback to about 20,000 today. For the other four species of rhinos, so two of those are in Africa and the other three are in Asia, they're all desperately endangered. For instance, the Javan rhino, there's only about 60 of those left, and they live in just a little tiny area out in western Java. The Sumatran rhino, all biologists will say, and we work in Sumatra, is that it persists in a few little pockets there, but we don't say where because we don't want poachers to get in there and wipe out those last individuals.
Poaching, how big a problem is it?
It's an enormous problem. It's a combination of things because the rhino's habitat is being, you know, destroyed and shredded and chopped up, especially by this huge expansion of roads that we're seeing happening all over the world. In particular, China is driving initiatives to expand roads all through the Asia-Pacific region and in Africa and Latin America and in Africa and in Asia. That, of course, is oftentimes putting roads right into some of the last wild places where rhinos survive. And that lets the poachers in, and then we've got poachers with automatic weapons coming in, and they're just gunning down the rhinos. And unfortunately, rhinos are, you know, they're big, they're kind of nearsighted, they're fairly predictable in their habits, so they're easy to shoot. Sadly, what the poachers do is just machine gun the rhinos, and then they chop off the horn and they leave the animal to rot. They don't use the skin, they don't use the meat or anything like that. It's just removing the horn, which can be worth thousands to even tens of thousands of dollars.
Now, you're part of a process of possibly letting rhinos run free in Australia. What's behind this?
The thing about Australia is we're seeing rhinos being wiped out of mostly developing nations with rapidly growing populations and relatively limited rule of law and lots of weapons. Well, Australia has large expanses of tropical and subtropical savannas and woodlands and rainforests, which is the kinds of environments where these rhinos live. And it turns out rhinos are not especially picky about what they eat. And pretty good rule of law, and Australia doesn't have firearms. It's much more limited and controlled here. So there really isn't, you can't really imagine that kind of poaching problem happening here.
Bill Lawrence said enormous bureaucratic obstacles would have to be overcome to introduce rhinos into Australia, and many countries would justifiably be reluctant to give up their rhino populations. However, he said as the situation becomes more desperate, it may be considered a serious option. Lawrence said he has received support from within the scientific community for this proposal as a way to breed up rhinos and other endangered wildlife so that they might one day be reintroduced introduced back into their native habitats. This news alert from VOA Asia. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi told Uganda's parliament on Wednesday that his country will open 18 new embassies across Africa. India, the world's most populous democracy, is vying for influence in Africa with its regional competitor China, which has aggressively developed trade, financial, and diplomatic ties on the continent. All the big stories coming your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Scientists announced Wednesday that they had discovered what appears to be a body of salty liquid water beneath the surface of Mars, raising the possibility of detecting life on the red planet. The reservoir, spanning about 20 kilometers in diameter under ice on the planet's southern pole, was found through a radar instrument on the Mars Express orbiter, which was launched in 2003. Researchers previously discovered signs that water did once flow on Mars. It's tempting to think that this is the first candidate place where life could persist on Mars, said Alberto Orose, a professor with the Italian National Institute for Astrophysics. He led the research published in the journal Science. He also said Mars may contain hidden bodies of water that have yet to be discovered. Orose said the size of the reservoir really qualifies this as a body of water. It's like a lake and not like some kind of meltwater filling someplace between rock and ice, he said. The scientists say the discovery gives them a roadmap to potentially finding life under the surface. Mars is cold, barren, and dry, but used to be warm and wet. The researchers say the water in the lake might have been kept from freezing due to a high concentration of salt. One scientist who was not involved in the study said microorganisms have been able to survive in similar conditions on Earth. In a new warning, the UN's World Meteorological Organization says the world is becoming increasingly vulnerable to the impact of climate change. It says this phenomenon is due to many factors and is not occurring at the same rate or degree around the globe. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WMO headquarters in Geneva.
Parts of the world are feeling the strain of record-breaking heat waves, drought, devastating floods, and raging wildfires. They are having a widespread impact on human health, agriculture, ecosystems, and infrastructure. The World Meteorological Organization reports climate change is influencing this trend in varying degrees. The chief of the WMO's World Weather Research Program, Paolo Ruti, says there's no discernible global pattern of climate change, but its impact is increasingly visible in certain areas, such as the Arctic.
We have seen wildfires in the Arctic. So there is a favoring conditions related to the fact that climate change is acting. So you are melting the permafrost. You have much more that vegetation that is available. You have sometimes you have stronger winds. So you have several factors.
Another interesting factor, he says, is a discernible increase in storms and lightning events, which also can trigger fires in the Arctic. He tells VOA that climate change in some places is happening faster than previously predicted.
It depends on what is your target, because if it is the Arctic, the answer is yes. So you see an acceleration of the melting in the recent 5-6 years.
WMO scientist Ruti notes this question needs to be put into context. He says what is happening in the Arctic regarding climate change would not apply to other global events such as sand or dust storms. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. Get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. Download our podcast. Take VOA Asia with you. Find us at voanews.com. We'd love to hear from you. VOA Asia Facebook, as well as our email at voaasia@voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Greg Burns, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a wonderful day.